This morning we have Matthew Peters with us. He is from the Chesapeake Multicultural Resource Center. And during our worship service, he's going to tell us a little bit about himself. He has a wonderful story of, I'll let him tell it. But he'll share that with us. He told this story to the mission committee a few months ago. We heard it, and then he shared some of what is going on in the Eastern Shore as it relates to immigration, certainly a big topic in the news today. And we thought, wow, this is something our whole congregation needs to hear, so we invited him to come. I assure you, as he talks about immigration, the Eastern Shore, it does not get political. He was very good about that, I thought, and but he does bring a wealth of knowledge and expertise in this subject. So he'll be talking about that immediately after our worship service.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for having me join you this morning to tell you a little bit about myself and a little bit about the organization I'm the director of. And our mission and our vision for the Eastern Shore. My name is Matthew Peters. I'm the executive director of the Chesapeake Multicultural Resource Center. Yes, it is a long name. So sometimes we just use our acronym, which is CHESMRC, and that sometimes confuses people too. But we're a nonprofit organization. We started our mission in 2012 here in Easton as a kind of a reaction to the demographic changes that have been going on here on the Eastern Shore for the past 15 years or so. So I was brought on after I had lived most of my life in Guatemala. I went down there first as a Peace Corps volunteer and then stayed for 11 years running my own organization in rural Guatemala. So I lived from 1999 all the way to 2012, not in the United States, so coming back here was quite a culture shock for me. And when I was tasked to work with this organization to start up an after-school program, my only real qualifications were speaking Spanish, and my background's actually in forestry, so I could identify trees. So when I was tasked to help immigrants, it sounded great, but then what does that really mean to help people coming to a new land? So our mission in 2012 is to empower immigrants in our community to become engaged and active community members and successful community members. Our vision is to make sure we have an Eastern Shore that is diverse and welcoming. We provide services to anyone who asks for them. So starting with our first programs in 2012 and our after-school program, even from that date, we have continued to see quite some demographic changes here in Easton and in other regions on the Eastern Shore. Over that time, really just by listening and getting to know our community, getting to know all the great and wonderful services provided here in Easton, and Easton is very unique in the number of services that it provides, and then listening to each and every story of our immigrants. I've been blessed through our office to hear nearly 3,300 different immigrant stories through our office. We've been blessed. I've been to work and interact with over 40 different nationalities just in our office here. So Talbot County and the Eastern Shore is very diverse. And through listening, we have become just very adept at finding where there's gaps in services, what can we do to really help and provide these services. So we provide both direct and indirect services. Indirect services are more just informing people about maybe cultural things or how to get things or where to find an attorney where the hospital is, things like that, those indirect services. But we also provide a number of direct services. So our office is accredited to do direct immigration work, so we're able to provide free immigration consultations, and I do represent clients free in cases as well. We also provide health navigation for health insurance through our office. Interpretation and translation services are all for free. And then one of the wonderful things, I get to go out into the communities and provide what we call cultural competency training. And I've been able to meet so many diverse groups, from giving training to all those at the Sheriff's Department, to everyone that works at Easton Utilities, I was just recently asked to go to Delaware and start providing training for lots of groups out there. So to really get down and have wonderful discussions about our own diversity, our own culture, and then embracing kind of and learning about the different cultures that are coming to the Eastern Shore. So as I said, we've through our offices over 3,300 clients. Every story is unique. So one of the things we mentioned is to stay away from the stereotypes and really get into the facts and the generalizations about these stories, which are unique. And it's been a wonderful journey. And I'm going to be staying afterwards today to answer any of your concerns or questions or if you've rumors, whatever you'd like to talk about. The important thing is to talk about our community, our immigrant community. And from our point of view, not only having lived in Central America to see the realities of life where you see on the news today, many are fleeing, but here just in our town to see, to be with families through the joy of getting their children to the first day of school, getting that parent all the way through the process of their holding up that citizenship certification, to see the children out on soccer fields, involved in Boy Scouts in our community. But we also do deal with the extreme hardships in our community that are a reality too. The heartbreak of family separations, of trauma, and discrimination that does exist in our community. So we're kind of well-rounded in the fact that we get to interact with our community at many different levels. We're not just there hearing the sad things that happen. We're there to experience the joy that happens in this community as well. So I invite you to stay after if you'd like to hear more about what's going on in Easton. Obviously, if you're interested in current news events, yes, those have direct ties to our community here in Easton. I'd be happy to talk you through that and provide some context and firsthand knowledge to those things, which I think is very important for all of us as citizens of Easton to understand. And I'll leave you just with a Bible quote that I think resonates with our mission. It comes from Hebrews 13, 1 through 3. It states, "Keep on loving one another as brothers and sisters. Do not forget to show hospitality to strangers. For by doing, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it." Thank you.
Okay, so this thing works then? Yeah. Very good. All right, so again, I'm happy to talk anything about our community, firsthand knowledge that I have, anything about my time in Guatemala. Also, I visit Guatemala quite often. I talk to people in Guatemala every day. So I'm able to share a lot of firsthand knowledge to a lot of stories that we just don't have the opportunity to really know about. And they're right here in our community. So don't be shy to ask any questions. I don't take offense at anything. No. There's a lot of stories that stand out, I could say. Sure. So one of the more common stories here is right now, you know, from Central America, and we classify it also in the news. We call it the Northern Triangle of Central America. So we're talking particularly about Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And this story for most of the families from here really starts about 19 years ago. There was a civil war in Guatemala for 36 years. It didn't end until 1996. So we know the images of civil war today. Same types of terrible atrocities during the civil war in Guatemala for 36 years. So Guatemala was never really introduced, and I can attest to that when I first got there in 1999, right after the war. Wasn't really even introduced to a modern society until directly after the war. There were no roads to my region. There were no roads to my community. There was no electricity. There was no running water. And that's really why I joined Peace Corps, was that was the experience I wanted. But after the war, with Reconstruction, and at the same time, free movement of people in their own country, those started making that journey north to get money to send back home. And we've heard stories of that. And yesterday, the Frontline newspaper said, every hour, $1 million is sent to Guatemala. to help the families there. So that story really started around 2000, 2001. And in my community where I lived up in the jungle, by 2003 or 4, 25% of the people had left to send that money back home. And that was the drive. That was the story that I hear. So from 2000 to 2009, the story was, I'm going to work. I'm going to work 40 hours a week, 50 hours a week, 60 hours a week. I'm going to send all that money back home. So for the first time ever, we can buy a piece of land, have a title to it, have electricity, have water. My kids will go to school, have clothes. First time ever to participate in that. So that was the story that really resonates with a lot of our community members here that came between the years of 2000 and 2009. Now, after that, the story changes. So with our economic downturn, at the same time with all that new development in Central America, that invited a whole group of people, the drug cartels primarily, into that region to take over. So that increased the corruption highly. That increased the violence. Now still the most violent area in the world. So then after that, the story started to change. It became less of coming here to send money back for opportunity. And the stories and what we hear today are people that can no longer exist there because of either the extreme poverty, the violence, the corruption, the hunger and starvation now, which was never a factor in those countries before. But now, hunger and starvation is a factor. The families coming in just this week, and as I go over their immigration case, the real reason for some of them was, my children are starving to death. I have to have money to buy them food. And there's no jobs, there's no opportunity. Here there is. And obviously, that's not a valid point for asylum, but that's the truth and the story that resonates. So again, this story that resonates with me, especially from Central America, has really been, for many families, a 19-year story and still going on. Obviously, we're in another chapter right now, an emotional one for our country. I don't know who comes next in our chapter, but that really is what's leading up to today. So those are the stories that I hear most common and that resonate the most. Sure. So that's part of our mission. Obviously, it's my world's with them every day. We do after-school programming, which is the most reflective. So our school systems, we're in our schools, whether we work in the elementary school every day, which is a wonderful place to come and meet our families. We also have a group of volunteers that work at the high school, and we work with two separate groups at the high school in mentoring programs. One is preparing children that are either immigrants themselves or their parents are just came and they're first-generation immigrants, and making sure they're ready for college. We haven't done a good job with that. There's been a lot of people fall through the cracks through that process. So we're there with a great group of volunteers to help them get ready for college. Then we also have another group of students in the high school, those who have just come up over the past week or two or three or four years, and we're there just really helping them to just let them know that homework isn't everything, you know, all this and everything. There's people here that care about you. We're going to help you through other things as they're just kind of imagine just being thrown into a high school coming from one of the places you'd come from. So we're there working with both groups, and you're invited to come and spend time with us as much as you'd like in those activities. Yeah, so our schools, obviously, for newcomers coming in, they focus a lot on what are called English language learners, and they'll provide services for them to understanding that it's very tough to learn math if everything's taught in another language. Math itself is another language. So the schools are providing those English as second language and trying to provide that support for the immigrant students, yes.
It up. Sure.
Yeah, so is everyone able to hear the questions? I forgot that's part of the my role up here. Her role was about, she volunteers and provides reading classes at the elementary school, and many of those who she sits and reads with are Hispanic, coming from these countries. And for me, the term Hispanic obviously doesn't mean much because most everyone I know in my life is Hispanic. But it does matter a lot of the culture, maybe where that family comes from, what that parent's educational level is. All those things do matter. And I can attest to when I was in Guatemala, outside of the library that I built and put books in, I'd never seen a book anywhere. That's just not part of reality there. So parents never grew up with books or reading. The children, obviously, it's just not part of that modern society yet. And even still today, as our schools have transitioned away from books, well, all the other countries are following our lead too, so they've already gone right to internet and things like that to teach. So books and reading, yeah, it's not as cultural of a thing as we would want it to be. So we're really starting from scratch with a lot of cultures with reading. Exactly, yeah. So she's asking if it's not just language, it's culture. Yes, because obviously if I go to places and some of the families I know, they're the most scholared people I know on this planet, as well as, you know, the publishers and papers there. So culture and language are two different things.
I'm curious about the numbers involved.
Sure. Sure. So his question is to give some scope of the numbers here in our school. So to give some scope to this story, if I go back to the year 2001, our elementary school was 1% Hispanic. If I look today, it's 39% Hispanic. Now, when you say, what is that Hispanic, where is it drawing from? The vast majority, 60% of all my Hispanic clients are from Guatemala. Followed by Mexico, Honduras, and Salvador. So it is a story driven by what we're seeing in the news today, just prolonged over time.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you mention college.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Good.
Yeah. So,
no,
some of them mostly don't. So Chesapeake College is usually where we can start. I know one young girl went to Salisbury. But I'll give you the example of where I say why we feel the need to be there, to be that little extra guide. I know all high school students need that guidance. Believe me, I know that. But I'm going to share this story just to kind of give you some of the what we don't talk about in schools. So a young woman, she got into Penn State, which is my alma mater. So I was duly impressed with that. She did her online financial aid things that she was eligible for the Stafford loan or whatever to help pay for it. So she processed that. She went up to State College. She started her first week of classes up there, and this is 2 years ago now. And then they called her into the administration office and said, oh, you need to pay your first payment of $22,000 by Saturday. Otherwise, you're out. And she's like, but I had that loan approved. And they said, well, you're a dreamer. And you've heard the dreamers on the news, the DACA. You are not eligible for any financial aid ever. The computer system, because they don't check. And she didn't understand, because no one was there to tell her, because she's been here since she was 4 years old, why she was different than her friend. So we went up there, and we talked, and we got her out. We got her back down here, very traumatizing for her. Got her set up in Chesapeake College, but then 3 weeks ago, she got a bill from Penn State University for that $22,000 still. So we're helping to fight that. So we're there because in the schools, they're not going to ask about Dreamers or DACA or all this documentation things. And because the Dreamers, because they get a work permit, that they get a Social Security number, So they can do all these applications, and because her income, her family's income is so low, she was eligible, but she can never actually get that money because of that political situation. No one. I mean, we're going to try and we have people on our board that know people that know people, so they're up there talking with the president to try and get a waiver. That's just for a week. So we want to make sure that, yeah, the schools, obviously, when it gets to those political issues, yeah, obviously it doesn't make sense to start asking them unless you're a trained professional, but someone needs to ask because a lot of these children are caught in that gray area. So that's why we're there. And that's why we can take them aside and we can get to build that trust so we can learn a little bit more about those political obstacles to make sure they're safe. And they can go, they all can go to college. We just got to make sure they get there without these hiccups. I think the college, obviously, through its just general education, gets them ready for an SAT test. We will help them. We help negotiate with some of the private trainings to get applications for a reduced rate. And then we do have a little bit of scholarship funds to help them pay for that because it can be expensive. Yes.
These people you work with, are they coming through the normal immigration process, or
are they just? So the question is, how are the people coming here in our community, the immigration process coming in? For those who aren't aware of our immigration system, which was really created in 1965, is when we created this system of a green card. You've all heard the green card. The green card is, that means legal. Every other thing you hear about would be undocumented still, no legal status, unless you have that green card. So what you may or may not know about our laws, our Congress sets an exact number of how many of these green cards we distribute every year. So it's a fixed number of immigrants coming in. So when we see, obviously, not following a fixed number of people coming in, yes, the assumption would be many are coming up through other means. Some coming in as a non-immigrant in some form or fashion and then staying as an immigrant. Others do manage a way to get up, whether it's through a border or a boat or a tunnel or a balloon, I've even heard once. And people go to great lengths. Most coming in come through the process we see now at El Paso, and if you've seen the news, where they're coming and turning themselves in to authorities and then wanting to fight their case in court for political asylum. So that's what most right now of our clients are going through that process through the court system to come here. But yes, the tough political question that I know you're getting at, most of the families that I work with are undocumented. They don't have the legal documentation or status to be here in the community.
Just a question. Mm-hmm. That individual that come through seeking asylum, that's still legal.
Oh, yeah. That's all.
They are legal. They're not green card holders. They're not illegal. That is a legal process.
Yeah, so that's why I understand where this his comment was, people coming up through any type of asylum process, that's our laws, and that's true. That is our laws written back not only in 1955 with the first refugee laws, but remade the same way or stronger in 1980. But that's why when we have that rhetoric and people say illegal and legal, it gets a little more complicated because that's a more black and white. Because I can have a person then in my office and work with them, and I have for months and months and months, and calling them illegal, and then all of a sudden they're legal. I get them their green card after lots of work. Case in point, our assistant director came here when she was 14 years old, undocumented, lived here most of her life, undocumented, was able to get a work card through that DACA program in 2012, has worked for us, and then we found a little loophole in her case. Very, very rare, and we're able to sponsor her, and now she's in the final stages of getting her green card. So she's been here for over 20 years, what we say undocumented or some illegal, but then now we find a way and we can get her legal. So that's why it's more of a gray area, and I don't, it doesn't help with the legal, illegal, because it's, I prefer documented, undocumented, because you could be undocumented for a week. We've had some people here undocumented for 20, 30 years, and then we find a way to get them documented. So those that do come up through asylum, that is a legal process, but they're still undocumented. They still have no documentation, in most cases, to work or any type of legal status, but they're still in a legal process.
You talked about asylum earlier. Mm-hmm.
So, as in any court of law, maybe is the correct answer. Now, when I do the asylum applications, I only feel comfortable doing them if I can answer the questions properly. And one of them is, you need to show that you fear for your life going back. Now, obviously, in the most violent countries in this planet, it's not a tough case to sell. However, depending on the judge, depending on the day of the week, depending on your attorney, depending on your personal story, all those things go into that maybe. So at the end of the day, it really is that individual person's case that's presented and all those other variables. There's some judges that approve 67% of the cases. There's a judge in some places that approve 0.01% of the cases. I mean, that's just the reality of our legal system. So it's a maybe. Now, they have a right to plead their case, strong or weak. Obviously, those coming from this region have a very strong case because of the reality where they're coming from. Not all, but most do. Now, saying that, the vast majority of people that have gone through the system are not granted asylum. Only 33% are granted asylum.
What do you do with the other ones that are?
It's tough. That's where we're at. And again, this isn't a story that's been going on 20, 30 years. And when a lot of people, I have a family here from Pakistan, I've been working with 7 years, they're still waiting for their first asylum court case or court date. And their youngest daughter, brilliant mind. All her friends are applying to the top colleges. She has better grades and scores than all of them. She's undocumented. She has no documentation because she's still waiting to get through this legal process. So she'd be getting incredibly depressed. So we're there to try and figure out ways to address this. But it's tough because sometimes the wait can be so backlogged now that a lot of these families aren't getting answers. So we'll get there. We'll get to an answer, and if that answer is they're rejected, then yes, we're going to have to deal with possible deportation in a lot of cases, and that's something we deal with in our community if people are deported here every week in our community. That's also a reality of people coming in. People are also being deported in our community. All right, let me just bounce around a little bit. Yeah. Yeah, so obviously, in my mind, what gets in the news too are these temporary work visas. But in my world, that's a migrant. That's someone who comes from a country, works, and they go. They don't call here home. This is to work. Then they go back home. Which and that has been going on and getting stronger over the past 15, 20 years in our country, especially here with our agriculture and craft. But then we see a reality difference saying, well, we've got plenty of people here that live here that could do this work, but we're not giving them permission to. And again, that's a political question, you know, meant for maybe a town hall with a congressman or someone to talk about some different solutions in that way. So now, yes, you can see the fight every 6 months And now they're changing the system, so it becomes a lottery system sometimes, and not so a crap. You never know if you're going to have workers. And we saw how that really affected a lot of our businesses last year. But they're two, in my mind, separate. One is migrant law and migrant passes, and we're dealing with, in our schools and our communities and everything here, our immigrant community. So both equally important, but very different politically, obviously. Mm-hmm. How do I view America in the future? This is more of a personal, I guess, question. As an organization, sure. Yeah, so I've been able to see a lot through my eyes. Again, a person that's literally been here for a day, I saw yesterday. And I've seen people that have been here for now maybe two generations, but still feel like they're getting integrated. So when I go and I work with our Haitian community, and I help them start businesses, and I work with the Pakistani community, I work with our Vietnamese community, now our Guatemalan community, Honduran community, I just see this as another tough but normal chapter in American history. This is, I think the best thing I heard was just 2 days ago, and I was listening to NPR driving to work, and they had a very extended piece about the crisis at the border, and they put it in a way that really resonated with me, that was El Paso is our Ellis Island of today, where people are getting funneled to one place, getting processed to come in, and I felt like that is a good way to view this chapter of our history, especially as it reflects to our community, and those numbers I gave. Is if we see it like that, like this is just a chapter of our, at least my generations and everything, Ellis Island, it's going to give us, obviously, a chance to improve on our past wrongs that we've done to immigrant communities and integration, and to improve on the American system, and to make sure that we don't wait as long, that we can learn from our mistakes and get people, like I said, integrated, up and working, successful, running, being part of our churches, or if they want to do their own church, that's fine too. Again, at the end of the day, it's all about a healthy community. So that's how I see it. Obviously, I see it's just inevitable that we're going to become more diverse. So the more that we understand that cultural uniqueness and differences, and we understand American uniqueness and Eastern Shore uniqueness, we're going to find good solutions. And I feel that every day, and that's kind of how I see it. The future. Yep. Our universities don't look at that at all. So universities, when they give a scholarship, it's based on their standards. When our state gives a scholarship, it's based on their standards. But even our state will give scholarships, like through our governor's office, to anyone. Our local community fund will give scholarships. You're not going.
The school doesn't fill that in.
Yeah.
There are several schools and more that are talking about it, but saying we will guarantee that all of your financial needs will be met with grants. So if someone does not come out of school,
that would be great, yeah.
Have you had a situation
No.
where part of your client has been accepted
to school? No. So, no, we haven't had anything where it's full. But, for example, a bright young woman that eventually went to Salisbury, she was excited and came to the office. She got married, accepted to St. Mary's. No, no, Notre Dame. I'm trying to know.
Well, St. Mary's is a female. There's a female.
So whatever. And they said, you're getting a $22,000 scholarship. And she was so excited. She said, this is where I'm going. They're giving me $22,000. And I'm like, oh, I hate to be the Grinch in this situation. Tuition's $41,000 a year. She's like, yeah, but they're giving me $22,000. I'm like, yeah, but your family doesn't make enough money to cover. Well, they'll work harder. And I'm like, I know your family will work harder, but again, you're still dealing with an 18-year-old. And, I go back to, I didn't know what money was. I could think my parents could just go and get more money, right? So that's why it's tough to be that. So I'm so glad that she did it. She was ready to sign all the papers to do that, and her family was ready to help her because they trusted her. And then we were able to really kind of get in there, do that tough love, and really, we don't want to bring your expectation down, but look at Salisbury. Salisbury is also offering you like a $4,000 scholarship. Their tuition's $9,000 a year, right? Your family can handle $5,000 a year, and that's probably all they can handle. And then she did. And she's hopefully we'll have more success there without that added pressure. So, yeah, obviously universities are starting to have to be more creative. But we had the Dream Act in Maryland, so our students can go to Chesapeake College for 2 years. Then they're eligible for any university here for an in-state scholarship or in-state tuition. So that helps. No, absolutely not. No. At all. No. No.
You mentioned community, patient community, the what about community. And I know that's important to maintain your roots.
Yeah.
But how would you help them part of the work?
So that's where we come in as an organization. So people ask that question. 6 years ago, and they put their money down. This isn't my money going to the organization. It's other people's money. And that's what we're tasked with. So we're tasked with how do we get there, which it was as easy as just maybe teaching an English class or, putting everything in a different language. It isn't. Trust is where it all starts, and we're doing that. So I don't know if anyone was able to see the news 2 weeks ago. The news came and did a whole story from Salisbury. I've been working with the Boy Scouts of America for a number of years. So we got 7 of our boys in Cub Scouts to pass over to one of our traditional groups here. So you get to see that kind of interaction. And now our troop here, 190, is actually majority Hispanic. Which, looking across that type of thing. Now that comes with its challenges, obviously. Not as easy as just doing that. But it really does help. And it's going to be a lot. It's a lot of work. But even with our soccer fields, YMCA, we've got to really work at that. And we're getting to get that integration going. Just this conversation, you having me here today to actually talk about it. What other opportunity do you have to talk about our community and learn? So we're doing it. Now, it's going to take time, patience, but at least we're doing it. We're not ignoring it. We're not saying, well, I don't like it, so I don't want to talk about it. As a community, we are stepping up. And we've done a project with our sheriff's department, social services, health department, schools, focusing on language and cultural competence. So I get to go out and do trainings to all types of groups. We have a language set up in Chesapeake College. We have an interpreter training program that we set up. It's in its second semester right now. We had 31 go through last summer. Right now there's 17 bilingual people going through that. So I have people from all of our community now getting trained to be interpreters. Their employers hear that. They're thinking these are going to step up to be those leaders. But we've got to provide them, listen to their stories, listen to where they're at, and provide them with the resources. Yes, but our big goal is that integration. And we don't want assimilation. It's different, right? I want them to preserve their language, believe me. I need Spanish speakers. I need Haitian Creole speakers. I need Vietnamese. I mean, when we lose that, that doesn't make us stronger. Right? So I want that, the religion, the traditions, the food. Oh, I love the food. Please keep the food. We want that. But we are asking, and they're asking, where can we? You know, and if we can do a bit, I have a graph where I show it. Obviously, you know, one is language. We don't need you to become perfect speakers. I'm not even a perfect speaker in English sometimes. And that's fine. But some, you know, economically. Obviously, if most of our community are at the lowest end economically, talking about integration, it's like, well, we're going to have to find ways to get more economically integrated as well. Residential. Right? In our community, incredibly segregated community. Eastern Shore. When I talk about the Haitian Creole population, when I talk about, well, I can name you exactly the streets where 95% of them live. Now, that's what it is. I'm not saying, you know, to put it good or bad, but how much integration is doing? So the mayor in Easton has a project of selling these homes in the East End, and I'm confident one of the first homeowners in there is going to be Hispanic, and I'll probably be the first Hispanic homeowner in that entire place. So those little things we start to integrate. Social. I mean, we talked about even helping here, trying to start up some of the social, at least religious networks that they have. We know it's so important. Social with the YMCA, social with the Boy Scouts. We're getting to that sliver. And then obviously, political. That's the one we're going to push a little bit more. Because when the door is shut, like you said, no, they can't get a student visa. They can't get this. They can't get permission to go work at a crab house. And it's like, well, how much can we start discussing that political integration? Again, that's a tougher one. But if we don't, yeah, the big picture of integration is going to be tough.
You find the numbers growing.
Yes, absolutely. So we have added over 110 students to school since September. We average about 5 new families a week through our office. So yes, when we hear terms like crisis and something, yes, something's happening. That's not debatable. I mean, yes, it's we've seen it here since September. Yeah, so here we've seen it. Before that, it was maybe about 1 or 2 a month students, and now it's about 5 a week. So yeah, it's interesting times we live in. So the question is about our community and the acceptance of it with this radical change kind of happening. Do I see it? Yes, obviously, because I think every time we talk about it, it gets better. I think when we don't talk about it, obviously, it hits us in the face like, oh, all right, this is still lots of people that haven't had this conversation. Obviously, I look nationally, and I think half and half, right? I would say I look here at the Eastern Shore. I'd say we're about half and half. I'm not trying to, when I do these talks, I'm not changing your values, I'm not changing your beliefs or what you think is right or wrong. It more is just about how do we just get different perspective and maybe look at an issue a different way to get to possible better solutions. Obviously, everything I see from our institutions, our schools, our police force, our town, they're focusing on community more than immigration status, which is good to see. But, yeah, we still have a lot of work to do. Obviously, we're in a very, a lot of rural communities are struggling with this. And it's understandable. I kind of read back on history when the Eastern Shore was really struggling after the bridge was built, with a lot of people from the Western Shore coming over, right? So I know it's historically it's tough, and it's something I understand people need to be concerned about with new developments and new everything like that, any type of change. I mean, yeah, if you're not there part of that conversation, it's going to seem negative. It's going to seem wrong. But if you can become part of that conversation, maybe it's a better way to do things. So hopefully we can get more people involved in the conversation rather feeling like they're excluded because they feel like their values are not being listened to, or they want for them to change radically their political attitudes or anything. But that's not what I think we need to do to get to a better land. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, our obstacle. Schools are a reflection of our community. That's a mirror. So the more you can get involved in the schools, the better. Mm-hmm.
For you.
Yeah.
If your next goal, your next you want to accomplish, what would that be?
Yes, it has. This week we launched the Capital campaign. We rent our space. We started off in a little church hall right here in Aurora that was donated to us. I had a closet they gave to us, and I cleaned out the closet and put my desk in there, and that's how we started. Then they're kind of like, well, we're going to be using this closet again. So we found a place in town. We're renting it. Obviously, we know what we're able to do, and we were confident. So we found a place on Dover Street right in the heart of our community where we want to be. We're looking to purchase that by at the end of this month. We launched an aggressive capital campaign so we can have a permanent home, something right there in the community to help with that integration piece, to help with that problem-solving piece right there. So that's something we're obviously we really want. It comes with a lot of space so we can continue to grow and add on a lot of community services. We host a lot of attorneys that come in to help a lot of times. Obviously, another one having discussions is maybe if we can get an attorney that can just start taking a lot of these cases and just see them through to the end. I can usually only start cases. I'm not an attorney. I am accredited, but I'm not an attorney. So I can only do the paperwork. I can't actually go to court. So something like that would help. And obviously, there's needs just for a bit of expansion. We're all pulled. We're very small staff. There's only three of us. And we're pulled everywhere. So usually there's only one of us at any one time in the office. Because one would be in the schools. One might be at a doctor's office. I'm called away to Caroline County two or three times a week. Queen Anne's County once a week. Now we're asked to go to Dorchester County. We're willing to because we know if we say no, there's not really going to be anyone there to address it and find solutions. So we are looking for a little bit, obviously, of capital to help us grow in that capacity. There's a lot to do. We've done a lot. But looking at the numbers, looking at where we're at and where we're going to be, so what I say is in 5 years' time, one out of every three of our graduates here will have an immigrant story as part of their story, a recent immigrant story. I know we all have immigrant stories, but one of these recent ones. Yeah, back.
I'm going to get to the
Yeah, so if you didn't hear, we spoke very clearly and loudly about a lot of the other things around human development, especially, like you said, mental health, which is one we focus on a lot. Our organization, we don't provide mental health services, but we work very closely as much as we can with Eastern Shore Psychological Services, with Midshore Behavioral Health. We've gone out and meet with them regularly for all seasons. Midshore Family Violence. It's the acronym got messed up in my head right now. So we do. So usually, in our offices, when we get to talking, most times we're the first people to hear it. So what do we do with that information? So we need to do our best to connect them. And it's not easy to connect people with those issues. So we stick with it. But we're there. Unfortunately, for my staff, it's tough because we need help sometimes to absorb it. But usually when it's a language barrier, they call on us to go in. So I've been in the hospital twice with attempted suicides to interpret. Luckily, I've gone through training. It's not enough training, believe me. I need more. Because it's predominantly there as a conduit to try and help with some of the other language and cultural things. I have to put all my trust and faith in that mental health provider, that if we can provide a language service and maybe some cultural connecting service, that they're going to be able to take it the rest of the way. But yes, I don't know what to do with the two kids whose mother was deported 4 weeks ago. And one already had learning disabilities and already goes to Kennedy Krieger. We're there to do what we can. And we have to depend, I have to depend on the expertise of these other places, but usually we bring them the cases as well, because we're able to hear more of that story. And that starts with trust. So the more we can have trust with people, and people know that when we have that sensitive information, that we're going to take it seriously and make sure we do what we can. But we have to just have our trust in our services here. I hope that kind of answered your question. One of the other realities in Guatemala right now is over 50%, 51% of all the children in Guatemala are chronically undernourished. And that means their body isn't developing as it should and their brains are not. That's just a reality. So when we get some of those children in and they act and look and they play the video games the same way, they play Pokemon the same way, they like Superman the same way, they wear Baltimore Orioles caps the same way. If we don't pay attention to culture and we ignore that, we treat everyone the same. Yeah, that's why culture is so important to talk. Yes, we treat everyone with love and dignity and the same. We do that. But there are differences. The differences are okay. And the more we can learn about those differences, the better we'll be. Differences aren't a negative. They're not good or bad. We're different. And so being able to go out and have those talks with lots of groups, I think it's really helpful.
We're at 12 o'clock. Lunchtime. I want to thank you, Matt, for coming. And I don't know if you're willing to stick around and people can talk to you further if you want to. I think hopefully we have some refreshments still. I don't know if the other folks will clean this out. But if we could have maybe a prayer before we close, let's pray. Oh, Lord, we thank you for the work that Matt is doing and those on his staff and his organization as how they try to treat people with respect and dignity and help them with the situations that they face right now. We know that the immigration crisis in our country is complex, and there are different views on how to deal with it. But we're talking about people who fear for their lives, people who are starving, people that you love. So we pray for this organization, for the Chesapeake Multicultural Resource Center, and the work that they do, and ask that you provide for them and help them to do this feeding. Thank you that we were able to learn things that we didn't know today, and help us to listen to your voice as how we might respond as a church, how we might respond as individuals. We pray this in the name of Jesus, who was an immigrant himself as he was a refugee into Egypt as a baby. Pray it in his name. Amen. Thank you, folks.